Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Member-Led Forum and your chair for today. Today's program is kindly co-sponsored with United Nations Association of the Bay Area. We're delighted to have their participation. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Jacob Foster is an associate attorney at Kasowitz, Benson, Torres, and Friedman in San Francisco. He earned his bachelor's degree from Northwestern University and a Juris Doctor degree from UCLA School of Law. He was admitted to the California Bar in 2007 after having clerked for Justice Edwin Cameron, Supreme Court of Appeal of South Africa, and Chief Justice Pius Lenga, Constitutional Court of South Africa. In 2011, he served on secondment in the office of the Chief Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. Less than a decade after its inception, the International Criminal Court is now at the forefront of the response to the most serious crimes of concern to the international community, such as genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. While proponents argue that the investigation and prosecution of such crimes are essential to deter violence, critics contend that the criminal proceedings impede peace negotiations and lead dictators to fight to the end. Foster, who worked on the arrest warrant for Muammar Gaddafi while on secondment in the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, explores the challenges and the complexities of international criminal justice. Please join me in welcoming Jacob Foster.
Thanks, first of all, to the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco for inviting me here to speak today. I'd also like to thank the United Nations Association for sponsoring this talk. And, of course, it wouldn't have been possible without the efforts of Linda Calhoun, the program organizer. I begin tonight by posing a provocative question. Do we dare to believe that an international court can help end impunity for the world's most serious crimes? Two millennia ago, Marcus Cicero declared, "In the midst of arms, law stands mute." And for much of human history, law had little to say about crimes committed in the midst of war. Yet, just 2 months ago, the International Criminal Court concluded its first case against a commander of an armed militia in the Congo that recruited thousands of child soldiers under the age of 15. And in the last month, a host of varied possibilities have emerged, some fanciful, others realistic. Voices around the world have called for the prosecution of Gaddafi, the self-proclaimed King of Kings, investigation and prosecution of the Pope, the living embodiment of God on earth. And just today, civil society groups in Mexico requested that the ICC investigate and prosecute the president of Mexico for human rights abuses committed in the war on drugs in that country. Although it's not likely that the ICC will investigate or prosecute in all of these situations, it is a sign of how far the institution has come in the less than a decade after its creation. Now, the institution is being discussed in efforts to combat violence by a leader to suppress peaceful demonstrations by his own population, become involved in a worldwide child abuse scandal, and potentially address abuses in efforts to combat one of the most intractable social ills in narcotics trafficking and consumption. why is there now hope that the force of law can begin to overcome the law of force? When Luis Moreno Ocampo was first offered the position as the first prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, a colleague of his at Harvard, where he was then teaching, famously recommended that he not take the position. He told Mr. Ocampo, "Why would you waste your time in The Hague for 9 years working for an institution that is not supported by the United States, Russia, China, and some of the other great powers?" And there was good reason to doubt that the court would be supported by these powers. John Bolton, then Undersecretary of State in the United States, stated that U.S. foreign policy was designed, quote, "to maximize the chances that the ICC will wither and collapse, which should be our objective," end quote. Yet, just this year, the United States, Russia, and China supported the first unanimous UN Security Council referral of crimes committed in Libya to the ICC. When Luis Moreno Ocampo arrived at The Hague in 2003, he arrived at a building with 15 floors, of which 6 floors were reserved for the Office of the Prosecutor. At that time, those 6 floors contained 2 professionals and 1 assistant. Now, there are over 800 employees at the ICC. There are ongoing investigations into crimes committed in 7 different countries, preliminary monitoring of situations in an additional 8 countries. 1 trial has recently been completed, and 2 trials are ongoing daily as we speak. And far from accomplishing nothing, the institution and the court has punched above their weight class. Shortly after a mass movement for democratic change began to sweep North Africa and the Middle East, Gaddafi announced that he would show no mercy and no pity on those who opposed his leadership. In response, the UN Security Council referred the investigation and potential prosecution of crimes committed in Libya to the ICC as a part of an international effort to delegitimize, isolate, and contain the Gaddafi regime. The recent events in Libya show the promise of a permanent international criminal court. However, they also illuminate the challenges that presently confront the institution. There are 3 key questions raised by recent events. First, is justice possible if the International Court has no police force to secure the rest of some of the world's most powerful men? As we speak, Gaddafi is on the run, but he retains money, military support, and political support. Second, even if arrest is possible, is it desirable to prosecute crimes at the international level, in The Hague at the ICC, as opposed to the national level? Now that the rebels have successfully overthrown the Gaddafi regime, some of the Libyan rebels suggest that Gaddafi and other regime leaders should be tried in Libya rather than in The Hague. And so a conflict arises between the understandable desire of national actors to prosecute leaders who committed terrible atrocities inside their country and the mandate of the ICC, which is to prosecute the perpetrators of the world's most serious crimes. Third, does the selective nature of international prosecution undermine the credibility of the institution? The UN Security Council has referred crimes in Libya to the ICC, but they have not referred the recent violence in Syria or other countries involved in the Arab Spring. Moreover, within Libya itself, the court has prosecuted Gaddafi, his son, and his head of intelligence, but it is an open question whether rebel forces will be investigated and prosecuted for alleged violations of the laws of war. Before I dive into a discussion of the ICC's current challenges in greater detail, let me shed a little light on how I ended up there. Early one morning in San Francisco, I received an email while walking to work. The email invited me to come take a visiting internship position in the immediate office of the prosecutor to start in 3 months. I had 2 weeks to make my decision. Although I was quite busy in private practice at the time, the opportunity to contribute to a cause greater than myself was one that ultimately I could not pass up. At that time, however, my knowledge was limited regarding the ICC's role and mandate. What little I did know stemmed in part from the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals created after World War II. In the aftermath of the war, Stalin initially proposed executing 50,000 to 100,000 German staff officers. Instead, tribunals were created to try the most serious of Nazi war criminals. At that trial, in a famous opening statement, Justice Jackson, prosecuting the Nazi leaders on behalf of the United States, stated, quote, that four great nations, flushed with victory and stung with injury, stay the hand of vengeance and voluntarily submit their captive enemies to the judgment of the law, is one of the most significant tributes that power has ever paid to reason. The Nuremberg tribunals paved the way for the ICC, and indeed, there were immediate calls for the creation of a permanent international institution. However, at that time, the world was not ready for an international criminal court. Cold War politics derailed the efforts, and violations of human rights continued around the globe. I was also aware of the genocides that were committed in Yugoslavia and Rwanda. In the aftermath of these genocides, ad hoc criminal tribunals were created by the United Nations to try the perpetrators of crimes. These tribunals were not without controversy. It took approximately 15 months for the great powers to reach agreement on the first prosecutor of the criminal tribunal in Yugoslavia, which they ultimately settled on in the form of Justice Richard Goldstone from South Africa. Furthermore, in regards to Rwanda, there was controversy whether the tribunal would be established inside Rwanda or outside the country. It was ultimately established in Arusha in Tanzania, leading to opposition from the Rwandan government. Both of these tribunals were established under Article 1 of the United Nations Charter, based on the proposition that prosecution is essential to international peace and security. This led to controversy and criticism from those who argue that the link between prosecution and peace is not well established, and further criticism from some who contend that in certain situations, the threat of prosecution can undermine the peace process by leading a leader to cling to power. These criminal tribunals, though, paved the way for the establishment of an international criminal court, a permanent court. And at Rome in 1998, the ICC was established by a vote of 120-7. The seven countries voting against the Rome Statute were China, Iraq, Israel, Libya, Qatar, the United States, and Yemen. The statute ultimately came into force in 2002 after 60 countries ratified the statute. The first prosecutor of the International Criminal Court is Luis Moreno Ocampo. He was selected after a distinguished career in his native Argentina, where he helped lead the prosecution of nine generals who were responsible for the disappearances of approximately 30,000 people. In preparing to go and work with Mr. Ocampo, I devoured the various information available about the ICC, information that's available in the news media, on the ICC's website, on their very informative YouTube channel. And I realized that a lot of the misperceptions about the ICC are due to a lack of understanding of its structural features. In particular, the mission of the court is very broad. It's to end impunity for international crimes. And the prosecutor's activities are also very broad. First, he can select the situations where to investigate. And this is quite different than all the criminal tribunals that came before the ICC, because in those situations, in Germany, Yugoslavia, and Rwanda, the country where the crime occurred determined the scope of the investigation. Second, the prosecutor has the authority to independently conduct the investigations and determine their strategic direction. And finally, the prosecutor has authority to prosecute and determine who will be prosecuted. However, there are significant limitations that circumscribe the power of the prosecutor. The first of these is territorial jurisdiction. The prosecutor can only investigate and prosecute crimes that are committed by nationals of state parties or in the territory of the state parties themselves. So, for example, whatever crimes would be committed by, say, Zimbabwe, Libya, or even the United States, the prosecutor would have no authority to investigate and prosecute them in a normal situation, whatever crimes were committed, because these are not state parties. There is, however, one exception to this territorial limitation, and that is the prosecutor can investigate and prosecute when the UN Security Council refers a country to the ICC for prosecution. And that is what happened first in the case of Darfur in Sudan and more recently in Libya. Another limitation on the ICC that's not commonly understood is what's known as temporal jurisdiction. The prosecutor can only investigate and prosecute crimes committed after July 1st, 2002. So whatever crimes were committed before that, for example, crimes committed by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, those are not within the scope of the prosecutor's authority at the ICC. Another limitation is what's known as subject matter jurisdiction. The prosecutor can only investigate crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, and in 2017, the crime of aggression. So, for example, although acts of terrorism committed by Al-Qaeda are undeniably horrific, the prosecutor has no authority to investigate crimes of terrorism. Although narcotics trafficking is a great social and international ill, the prosecutor has no authority to investigate such crimes. And although child abuse committed by priests is undeniably horrific, The prosecutor can only investigate crimes against humanity that are committed pursuant to a state or organizational policy. And whatever you think about the church's efforts to confront child abuse, I think it will be difficult for proponents of an ICC investigation to argue that such acts were committed pursuant to a policy. A final limitation, and probably the most important, is what's known as complementarity. The prosecutor has a duty not to investigate when the national states are conducting investigations. The prosecutor has to defer to genuine national investigations because this is the model that was developed in Rome. It's a model based on the idea of a coalition of states who have committed via the Rome Statute to prosecute these crimes themselves in their national jurisdiction, but have accepted under the treaty that when they do not prosecute, the ICC can step in. So, for example, there are crimes that have been committed in Colombia, but the prosecutor has not investigated or prosecuted there because their national system has made a commitment to investigate those crimes at the national level. You might be asking yourself, what I did exactly while I was at the ICC. Although I worked with the prosecutor on all of the cases under investigation, I'm going to focus today on three specific cases, one in the Central African Republic, one in Kenya, and another in Libya. In parallel with extensive training, the first thing that I did when I arrived at the ICC was to watch one of the three trials that at the time were going on every day. And the one I watched was that of Jean-Pierre Bemba. Bemba is the former vice president of the Congo. He came in second in the presidential elections in that country in 2006 and has a reputed net worth of several hundred million dollars. In 2003, the president of a neighboring country in the Central African Republic, facing a rebellion, invited Bemba to send in his troops to help fight off the rebels there. Troops under Bemba's control entered the Central African Republic and went on a rampage, committing human rights abuses and crimes of rape, pillaging, and murder. Before he sent his troops into the Central African Republic, the prosecution alleges that Bemba stated, quote, "You are going to the Central African Republic, which is not your country. In that country, there are no parents or big brothers or little brothers or any of your family. When you get there, do the job that I am asking you to do. Anyone you encounter in the combat zones will be an enemy." When you go to view proceedings at the International Criminal Court and enter the public gallery after going through security, you get a headset which allows for simultaneous translation from an armed guard, and the first thing you notice is really your closeness to the proceedings. You look through a plexiglass barrier, and in the center, you see judges selected from the member states of the ICC, their law clerks in front of them. On the right, attorneys for the prosecution, and also attorneys for the victims. And on the left, attorneys for the defense, and Mr. Bemba himself. The one person that I did not see, and that you typically do not see from the public gallery, is the witness, as screens block your view of the witness from the public gallery. The reason for this is concerns about witness safety and retaliation. What you do hear is their voice, first in their native language and then translated, in my case, in English, by a translator, recounting horrific events that were visited on themselves and their family members. One of the first witnesses I heard testify was a male community leader who testified that he was sodomized by Bemba's troops in the presence of his wife and children. He said that over a period of 4 days, the Congolese soldiers repeatedly raped his children and wives too. He said, quote, "When they felt the need to sleep with a woman, they would come back. I felt as if I was a dying man. Later on, every time I saw a Zairean national, I always have this feeling that I want to get a hold of him and strangle him, but I can't do anything." It takes courage and strength for villagers to travel outside their city, outside their country, to The Hague, to sit in a courtroom, in many cases, using a foreign language, and to have the opportunity to have their voice be heard, and to actively confront the person who is responsible for their pain. And when you're at the ICC working late into the night, you want to make sure that the victim's efforts are not in vain. It's their trust in the court and indirectly in yourself that compels you not to rest. One of the amazing things about working at the ICC, though, is the opportunity to work with attorneys of different nationalities, different languages, different backgrounds, different legal cultures, coming together from all over the world with one objective: to weigh in on behalf of the victimized and against those who have abused positions of great power, trust, and responsibility. For example, in the months that I was at the ICC, I would occasionally discuss the Bemba case over coffee with a colleague from the Central African Republic himself. And one of the things he said was, "Yes, we should prosecute Bemba, but why not others? Why not the president who invited Bemba into the country to fight off the rebellion? Why not the rebels, who, although they were defeated by Bemba's troops then, ultimately returned a year later and took control of the country?" Now, you'll remember that I mentioned the fact that the court was not exactly expected to get off the ground in its first years of existence. And debate in those first couple years was between those who opposed the idea of the court itself and its supporters, who had to rally around the court and fight for its very existence. But as the court has become established, even supporters of the court have found space to offer criticism of its tactics and decisions. And the criticism my colleague was raising in this instance was of a strategy known as self-referrals, which is when a country refers itself to the ICC for the ICC to investigate and prosecute criminals there. In the first three cases brought by the ICC in the Congo, Uganda, and the Central African Republic, the governments of these countries all referred themselves to the ICC. And you may be asking yourself, why would a government ask that the ICC investigate its own country? International crimes historically have been committed by governments in power in Germany and Yugoslavia and in Rwanda. And you do not typically see criminals effectively calling the police on themselves. So one potential reason is that these governments might think that the ICC will investigate their political opponents, but not investigate government officials in power. In the Central African Republic, for example, Bemba is the only individual who has been prosecuted by the ICC. And obviously, the challenge for the prosecutor is to maintain his independence and impartiality to follow the evidence wherever it leads, even in situations of self-referrals. This issue of case selection is a very complicated one. At the Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, for example, one of the prosecutors made an effort to prosecute all sides of the conflict, all ethnic groups, and many observers criticized that as creating a false equivalency between the crimes committed by each side. And the prosecutor has justified his decision not to prosecute government officials in some of these self-referral situations on the grounds that the crimes committed by those officials are not of the same gravity as those committed by the individuals that are being tried. Although the first three cases in the initial years of the ICC were self-referrals, none have occurred since. And in the Kenya case, which I'll talk about next, high-ranking figures from both sides of the post-election violence have been prosecuted. Just prior to my arriving in The Hague in December of 2010, the pretrial chamber there issued summons to appear for six individuals allegedly responsible for the post-election violence in Kenya. This case attracted a lot of attention for a number of reasons. It is the first stable, economically prosperous, and democratic country where the ICC has acted. It is also the first instance where the prosecutor himself has used his so-called proprio mutu powers, which is his own authority, to open an investigation. All the other situations were either cases of self-referral by the government or referrals by the UN Security Council to the ICC. The case is also highly visible because leading contenders for the presidency of Kenya in 2012 are among the accused. The background to the case is that there was a disputed 2007 presidential election between President Kibaki and Raila Odinga. Kibaki is primarily supported by the Kikuyu ethnic group, while Odinga was supported by the ethnic Kalenjin community. The first Kenya case against William Ruto, Henry Koski, and Joshua Tsang contends that they organized a network primarily made up of the Kalenjin community with the design to commit ethnic violence in the event that it was perceived that President Kibaki stole the election. And in the aftermath of the disputed 2007 election, violence broke out. The Kenya 2 case against Francis Muthara, Uhuru Kenyatta, and Muhammad Ali contends that in response to this violence, primarily directed at the Kikuyu population, these high-level government officials organized retaliatory attacks by a criminal organization known as the Mungiki and directed the Kenyan police forces not to intervene in the Mungiki's attacks on the civilian population. I had a lot of personal interest in the Kenyan cases as a result of clerking on the Supreme Court of Appeal and Constitutional Court of South Africa, and also living in Africa. And I was profoundly aware of two diametrically opposed narratives about the ICC's involvement in Africa. The first view is that the ICC is targeting Africans for prosecution and a new form of neocolonialism. Sean Ping, the chairman of the African Union, has argued, quote, "There is a problem with ICC targeting only Africans. But if ICC always targets only the Africans, does it mean you have nothing in Gaza? Does it mean you have nothing in the Caucasus? Does it mean that you have nothing in the militants in Colombia? There is nothing in Iraq. We are raising this type of question because we don't want the double standard." The second view, however, is that ICC intervention is necessary in Kenya to break the cycles of ethnic violence that occurred in past elections caused by historical favoritism, resource control, and poverty, among other reasons. Notably, public opinion polls in Kenya have shown strong support for the ICC process. And the deputy prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, has made the point, quote, "We say that the ICC is targeting Africans, but all of the victims in our cases in Africa are African victims. They are not from another continent, and they're the ones who are suffering these crimes." What both these narratives assume, however, is that the ICC is powerful enough to both target heads of state and politically powerful members of society, and also provide justice for the victims entirely by itself. There are reasons to question these assumptions. The ICC has famously been compared to a giant without arms and legs who needs artificial limbs to walk and work, because the ICC must rely on the individual or collective efforts of states to assist the court in a variety of ways. When I first got to the ICC, I was somewhat naive about the difficulties in investigating international crimes. The traditional tools of national jurisdictions that are used to conduct criminal investigations simply do not exist at the ICC. Here in the United States, if the U.S. Attorney's Office wants to conduct an investigation, they might employ such tools as wiretaps to enable them to listen in and record conversations of suspects, searches and seizures where they go to someone's business or property and secure evidence, computers, files, etc., and also the use of grand jury subpoenas, which compel individuals to come and testify. The ICC has none of these tools. And one of the powerful things about working there is the ability to interact with investigators at the court. And in speaking with one investigator, he spoke about how he thought that when he came to the ICC that he would be on the cutting edge of investigations. But really, all he had was the equivalent of a butter knife, because if he wanted a wiretap, a search and seizure, any of these investigative tools, he was completely dependent on the nation states where he was seeking to investigate. And the prosecutor, William Moreno Ocampo, has himself said, quote, "The most interesting part of this court is normally when you are a criminal prosecutor, you or a judge have the possibility to give instruction to the police. When I was a prosecutor in Buenos Aires, I had 30,000 policemen who can follow my instructions. Here, I have at least 118 states in my jurisdiction and zero policemen." The ramifications are significant for the ICC, both in investigations and prosecutions. You must engage in greater creativity without state cooperation, since you can't compel forensic or documentary evidence. You have to rely on national commissions and reports, the use of defectors or witnesses outside the country. In the Kenya case, at the recent confirmation of charges proceedings, the prosecutor has been criticized for not having evidence such as cell phone records, military transit details, logs of visits to various locations to back up the statements that he's received from insider witnesses. However, in a large part, prosecutions cannot be effective without cooperation from the states themselves. One complication is that the ICC only focuses on the persons most responsible for crimes. And this follows other international tribunals, such as in Nuremberg, which focused on the top Nazi leaders. However, it's interesting to note that normally, in the domestic context, prosecutions are bottom-up rather than top-down. So in the U.S., prosecutors were ineffective in addressing organized crime until they focused on flipping cooperating witnesses and using testimony from these accomplices to implicate mob bosses. Accomplice testimony is necessary because the most culpable and dangerous individuals rarely are involved in the dirty work. What this suggests is that the ICC may need to expand its prosecution methods from only targeting the highest level individuals to also considering targeting mid-level members of the conspiracy. Another difficulty is with arrests, where the primary responsibility to execute warrants of arrest rests with the territorial authorities. In Kenya, the suspects appeared voluntarily, while in other situations, suspects have flouted the court, both with Bashir in Sudan and with Gaddafi, the case I'll talk about next, in Libya. In Libya, the UN Security Council asked the ICC to investigate and determine whether to prosecute leaders with the expectation that Gaddafi and top leaders would be indicted in the midst of an ongoing conflict. The Office of the Prosecutor did just that in real time. It sought arrest warrants based on the evidence it gathered, and the court issued warrants for Muammar Gaddafi, his son Saif, the de facto prime minister, and Abdullah al-Sanusi, Gaddafi's brother-in-law and the head of military intelligence, the man the prosecutor described as the executioner. The quick response illustrates the promise of a permanent international institution. In Libya, it took only 4 months from the Security Council referral to the issuance of an arrest warrant, while in Darfur, it took approximately 2 years for the same process to occur. And it was part of a broader diplomatic effort to contain Gaddafi and force him to leave power. While it initially led to a debate as to whether it was complicating the chances for peace, it appears that Gaddafi had many opportunities to leave, both before and after the arrest warrants were issued, and there's little evidence to suggest that the threat of prosecution was a significant factor in leading him to stay and fight on. Catherine Ashton, the EU representative for foreign affairs, has said, quote, "Sometimes the toughest question in world politics is, and then what? And after the Libyan rebels have been successful in overthrowing the Gaddafi regime and starting efforts to create a new government, it's created a debate about whether Gaddafi's and others should be tried in Libya or at the ICC. The state of the justice system in Libya is similar to a number of other countries where the ICC has investigated. It has limited capacity to try high-level leaders. The ICC, in contrast, has experience, expertise, and has conducted an investigation. But of course, national trials have certain advantages that cannot be obtained in The Hague. They contribute to respect for the rule of law. Since justice is being done locally, it's more visible to the population. And moreover, the ICC itself does not have the capacity to try all potential accused. A recent story by Mark Herman in The Atlantic magazine illustrates the limits of the ICC's authority. He told a story about a family who was on Tripoli Highway. They were stopped at a checkpoint. Soldiers at that checkpoint, pro-Gaddafi loyalists, shot at their car, killing, among others, young children. Now, these foot soldiers will not and should not be charged at the ICC. But there is also currently no legal institutions in Libya equipped to try them. One potential solution is for the ICC to pursue its cases in Libya itself, to have the seat of the court there, and if Gaddafi and others, the high-level leaders, are caught, to prosecute them there. This might address some of the concerns about outsourcing justice, and it might also allow the ICC to contribute to building up and partnering with the new Libyan judicial system to address the huge numbers of perpetrators who have committed crimes in Libya but simply cannot be tried at the ICC. At the beginning, I posed the question, do we dare to believe that an international court can help end impunity for the world's most serious crimes? I think we can dare to believe because of the change that we have seen and are continuing to see. It took the atrocities of the Nazi concentration camps to bring the international community together for the first time to try perpetrators of war crimes. The tribunals that were created in Rwanda and Yugoslavia paved the way for the ICC. In 2002, the ICC was established with 60 member states. Now, the ICC has jurisdiction over 118 nations with over 2.4 billion people. Confronted with the violence in Darfur, the international community debated for months over whether the ICC should become involved. With Libya, there was a consensus that the court should respond to the crimes. Of course, we must be realistic. We are just at the beginning of a pivotal new era in international law, and the success of the ICC remains tremendously fragile. The high-profile nature of the cases leads to zero margin for error, but investigations and prosecutions are incredibly challenging. Selectivity is an endemic part of any system of justice, but all of the current cases are occurring on the African continent, and the perception that it is an African criminal court, not a truly international criminal court, undermines needed support for the institution, even if those allegations are baseless. Finally, the court lacks resources. It is a relatively small institution, and the great powers are not parties, so only a few countries are paying bills. This could, in fact, constrain the capacity of the court to take on more cases at the time when the need is incredibly great. And these types of funding constraints could make the court more selective and less consistent. And of course, one of the obstacles begins at home, something that I was frequently reminded of by my international colleagues who pointed out that their important work has been undercut at times by American law. American concerns about politically motivated prosecutions of soldiers are legitimate, but engagement is overall consistent with American values and history for supportive accountability that began at Nuremberg. It would be difficult to imagine, even 20 years ago, if a dictator like Gaddafi was attacking civilians, that the international community would hold an individual head of state criminally responsible for his acts. There are problems with selectivity, with enforcement, and with arrests, but it is a new idea and a new norm that limits the permissible use of force by leaders. It is the law that leaders cannot use violence against their own population to stay in power. And it is up to the lawyers in the prosecutor's office and those in the general public who support them to make sure that they have the resources, the political support, and the backing to continue elaborating, refining, and improving these critical ideas in the area of international human rights. Thank you.
Our thanks to Jacob Foster, former attorney in the immediate office of the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, for his comments here today. I'm Linda Calhoun, vice chair of the club's International Relations Forum, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. We have a large number of questions, so let's begin. And I'll start with one of the first ones in terms of resources. How is that constraint being addressed, Jacob? What efforts are taking place to make sure that the ICC has the funding it needs?
Thank you. That's a wonderful question. And as I touched on today, resource constraints are an issue, particularly when you consider the fact that at the beginning of this year, probably no one would have been able to predict the events that have subsequently occurred in the Middle East and North Africa. These new situations and the investigations that are occurring lead to a greater strain on the ICC's resources than was or could have been expected. And I think one of the very innovative things that the Office of the Prosecutor has done is to make the investigation and the response a truly international effort with burden sharing among international organizations such as the UN, Interpol, and leveraging the activities of nation states in the region and also the investigative agencies of other state parties to help contribute to the investigations and prosecutions in a way that is not a tremendous strain on the resources of the court. But make no mistake, the court needs more resources. Funding is a concern because it draws on funding from the states that are members, and not all countries in the world are members of the ICC.
Great. And how are the judges elected or appointed for the ICC?
That's an excellent question as well, and I think it's a very timely one because we're about to enter into a period of tremendous change at the ICC. You're not only going to have new judicial elections, but you're also going to have a new prosecutor who will be elected in December of this year, a new registrar, and there will be significant turnover among the key heads of the institution. So it's an exciting process as the court moves to the second round of personnel after the initial years. And all of those individuals are selected from the member states. They go through a process whereby there's nominations and then eventually a selection process where they get appointed and selected for the court itself.
And just a point of curiosity, prior to your going to the California bar, you worked with judges in South Africa. Did they help in terms of your work with the ICC?
Yeah, thanks. The South African experience was an incredible one, and it was something that in a lot of ways led me to the ICC, both because it exposed me to the incredible world there is out there in terms of different legal systems and the innovative issues of constitutional law and human rights law that we're not only confronting here in the United States, but also are being confronted abroad. I was actually led to the ICC in a lot of ways by a co-clerk of mine who clerked with the Chief Justice Pius Longa with me, and she's of Ghanaian descent. And after she was done with her clerkship in South Africa, she went and clerked at the ICC for a judge there who's from Ghana. And after sharing her experience, which was a wonderful one for her, and she discussed at length the tremendous opportunity you have to interact with attorneys from all around the world. And she informed me of the fact that the prosecutor's office also occasionally accepted interns and visiting professionals to come assist their work. So that was sort of the idea, how it germinated for me. I applied. I didn't hear anything for a very long time. And then, as I mentioned, I was walking to work one day and got the message on my BlackBerry. And, of course, both Chief Justice Longa and also Justice Cameron are incredible, legendary figures in Africa. And without their support, I never would have made it to the ICC, and they both played an incredible role in the development of my skills as an attorney.
Great. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to a program on the International Criminal Court with attorney Jacob Foster. Jacob, has Gaddafi been indicted by the ICC? If he can be captured, will he be tried? And will it be in The Hague? And what about the same treatment for Assad of Syria?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So Gaddafi, there was an application for an arrest warrant, which was filed by the prosecutor. Shortly thereafter, the judges of the court reviewed the application and the lengthy evidence supporting it, and in fact issued the arrest warrant. There's now a warrant of arrest outstanding, and all the state parties have an obligation to arrest Gaddafi if he's in their territory. Also, Interpol has issued a so-called red notice to all the countries around the world requesting that Gaddafi be arrested, of course, if he is found. And in regards to Syria, that's an issue that I touched on earlier. Selectivity is, of course, an inevitable issue in both domestic prosecutorial practice and certainly at the international level. And all the criminal tribunals have been criticized on this basis, whether at Nuremberg or in Yugoslavia or in Rwanda, and a similar criticism is leveled at the ICC. As I mentioned, I think one of the misperceptions that people have is that the ICC has the ability to investigate in Syria but is just deciding not to do it for some reason, and that is not the case. The prosecutor has the authority to investigate in the countries which are state parties, and he can only investigate in a situation like Libya or Syria if the UN Security Council refers the case. And so it's a fundamental question. Is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? Since the court was first established, we've gone from 60 state parties to 118 state parties. So it's a new idea. The support for it is growing. And I think the critical question is, were there crimes committed in Libya? And I think it's undeniable that there were crimes there. The evidence is compelling that Gaddafi was responsible for them. And I think it's important to support the court's work there, notwithstanding the fact that you do still have this universe of countries that are not state parties where political calculations are involved as to whether the ICC can investigate.
You know, you spoke about the Rome Statute, and I have a couple questions here from our audience members who are questioning, you know, what law is the basis for the court's work, whose constitution, if that's it, human rights law. So can you talk a little bit more about what legal precepts actually direct the work of the ICC?
Sure. The ICC is a treaty-based organization, and so it's the Rome Statute itself that is the governing law. It directs the prosecutor which crimes he can investigate, where he can investigate, and it sets forth the legal principles and norms that bind individuals in those countries that have signed on to the ICC. And if you look at the court's website, you can find not only the Rome Treaty itself, but a detailed variety of legal tools which explain in depth the elements of each one of the crimes and the exact things that have to occur for the ICC to prosecute. Of course, the court does look at relevant decisions, particularly those of the tribunals in Yugoslavia and Rwanda, but to a certain extent, the law under the Rome Statute is sui generis.
Okay. Is there an appeals process?
Yes, that's a great question. And the judicial branch of the ICC is separated between a pretrial chamber, a trial chamber, and an appeals chamber. And so the pretrial chamber has the task of assessing whether there is sufficient evidence for the prosecutor to open an investigation in certain countries if he's required to seek the chamber's approval to open an investigation. It's also tasked with determining whether arrest warrants or summons to appear may be issued for specific suspects, and it plays a critical role, as we've recently seen in the confirmation of charges proceedings in the Kenya case, in ascertaining whether there's enough evidence for the case itself to go to trial. And if the pretrial chamber performs this gatekeeping function, then the trial chamber itself will be responsible for conducting the trial. And the appeals chamber really can be involved at either time when there's appeals, procedural or substantive, from the pretrial process, or also, of course, if there is a conviction by the trial chamber. And the, as I mentioned, the prosecution just finished its first case recently in August, and you know, if the individual is convicted, I would certainly expect that he will appeal.
Great. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. And one of our audience members writes about the principle of the responsibility to protect. Does this enter into the discussions by prosecuting attorneys as they prepare legal strategies? And also, it leads to a question that I had on a more specific level. As you're dealing with witnesses and you're preparing the cases for the ICC, how are witnesses protected? I mean, how are they able to be taken care of as you're developing cases?
Yeah, I think those are great questions. In regards to the responsibility to protect, it's not something that explicitly enters into discussions by prosecuting attorneys. I think that is a notion that deals with the obligations, which some believe are incumbent upon the international community to intervene when a state has failed to protect the population within its territory from violence. And so in certain situations, some in the Libya case argued that as a political matter, the international community needed to intervene because of this responsibility to protect principle, but it's not something that guides the prosecutor's decision-making. His guide is really the Rome Statute and the evidence of crimes committed under it. In regards to the witness protection question, I think that is a fantastic question, and it's one that's incredibly important and difficult in the context of international crimes where the witnesses are primarily located inside a country, perhaps where the people that are responsible for atrocities are in power or who have allies or organizations that still retain a modicum of power in that country. And the ICC does not have a witness protection program in the sense of the one we have in the United States and that we see on TV.